Well, first of all, one announcement, test next Tuesday, I believe it is, scheduled for in here. Since it's been a while since we've been here, if you remember, we were talking about the Kingdom Plantae, and we talked about three divisions of aquatic plants. We talked about, so we had the aquatic plants, we talked about the Rhodophyta, Theophyta, and the Chlorophyta. And we talked about some of the differences between terrestrial and aquatic plants. Spend a little bit of time on that, some of the terrestrial plants. Today, in the next couple of days, we're going to talk about a couple of other groups of plants. We're going to talk about one group of plants that is what I call the transitional group between the aquatic and terrestrial environments. They kind of have characteristics of both terrestrial and aquatic environments. We're going to talk about a few divisions of what we call the lower vascular plants. Then we'll talk about a group of plants called the gymnosperms. And then finally, the angiosperms. So today we want to start out by talking about this transitional group of plants. The transitional group of plants belong to the division Bryophyta. The division Bryophyta are sometimes called the mosses. Now again, what a lot of people call mosses are actually not mosses, but green algae. But mosses are a fairly common group of organisms. This is a picture of some moss here. Mosses are basically found near aquatic environments. They don't have any vascular tissue, and so they've not evolved to survive completely on land. However, they cannot grow in water, right in the water. They need to grow kind of around where there's water or where it's moist in the environment. Now there are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is that they do not have pollen grains yet. They have flagellated sperm. Anytime we see flagellated sperm in plants, we know that the plants need to survive in aquatic or semi-aquatic areas. And the reason for that is that flagellated sperm, if it gets out into a dry environment, will actually dry out very, very quickly. Therefore, it can't, and also it needs water to swim. Now, some of the environments where you will find mosses are not around, say, for example, a stream or a lake. But they may be on, say, for example, in the middle of a forest on the north side of a tree or something. And that's kind of a moist environment. The flagellated sperm do not necessarily need a body of water like a stream. But they can actually swim through humidity in the air. And so places that are very, very humid, you may find mosses. Okay, does that make sense? Or you see a lot of mosses, for example, when I was up in Vancouver, British Columbia, or in Seattle, Washington, there's fog that comes off of the ocean. That fog, of course, is water, and those flagellated sperm can swim through that type of an environment. Okay. The second reason why they're found near aquatic environments, the second way that we can tell that they're found near aquatic environments is that they don't produce seeds, they produce spores. And these spores are actually quite similar to the spores that we talked about with the fungi. Now, we talked a little bit with the when we were talking about fungi, about the differences between spores and seeds. But spores, when they land in an environment, if the environment isn't suitable, they actually die somewhat quickly, okay, within a few hours. Whereas a seed, if it lands in an unsuitable environment, it doesn't necessarily die. It kind of sits there and waits for the environment to become suitable, right? For example, if you dropped a seed in the room here, it's not a good environment for the seed to grow. But the seed might get kicked out the door and out the outside door here and get kicked into the flower bed outside the door. Does that make sense? Or into the lawn. And so then it has a suitable environment where it can germinate. Now if a seed is not in a suitable environment for a long period of time, then it may die as well. Okay. Some seeds can stay viable for hundreds of years. They've actually found seed in pyramids that they could germinate. Whether or not those seeds were, the big argument among scientists was, were those seeds put there by the Egyptians, or were they seeds that mice have taken in there? You know, that's always a question. It's hard to tell how old they are. But some seeds we do know have long viability, or they're alive for a long period of time. Other seeds are much shorter. But most seeds, when they land in an environment, they can wait for a short period of time, if not a long period of time, in order to germinate. Okay? And the third reason why we know that Bryophyta needs to live near a moist environment is because they have no vascular tissue. So if they have no vascular tissue, they have no way of transporting nutrients and water throughout the plant. Okay? And so water needs to kind of be around the plant, if not not again in the form of a body of water, but in the form of humidity, fog, something like that. Okay, moisture in the air. Right? Any questions about that? Now, mosses actually have kind of a unique life cycle. They're a little bit different than most other plants and animals. Most plants and animals, we say that they have a sporophyte dominant generation. Or what that means is that most of the, for example, in humans, we're 2N, and then we go through meiosis, we produce 1N gametes, so 1N gametes fuse and we become 2N, and then the organism's 2N until they reproduce, right? That's kind of what we normally think of as a life cycle as far as numbers of chromosomes. Mosses are a little bit different in that they have what we call a gametophyte dominant generation. In other words, the picture of the mosses that I showed you, this picture here showing these moss, this moss down here, all of those structures are actually 1N. Okay, so the actual green part of the plant is 1N, or what we call a gametophyte. All right. Now notice as well that they do not have roots. These organisms still have rhizoids, kind of similar to some of the aquatic plants that we talked about. Again, they don't have roots because there is no vascular tissue. Okay. Another characteristic that would kind of make the mosses unique before we talk about the rest of their life cycle is when you look at their leaves, when we drew the cross-section of a leaf, we had the upper epidermis, and we had palisade cells and spongy mesophyll and all those other things, right? Okay. In a moss, if we were to look at a cross-section of moss leaf, what they have is they have a leaf that is only one or sometimes two cells thick. Okay, so there is no vascular tissue involved here with the leaf. It's just one or two cells thick. That makes sense to everybody. So a fairly primitive type of a leaf. Okay. Now this professionally drawn picture shows the life cycle, but what I'd like to do is draw the life cycle as well up here and just talk a little bit about the gametophyte dominant life of the mosses. So in mosses, there are distinct male and female gametophytes. So here we have a gametophyte, or what we would normally think of as the plant with the leaves and so forth, right? Okay. And this, for example, is just an individual, and it might be a male. Okay. Another gametophyte here is 1N, and it may be a female. Okay, so you have both male and female gametophytes, and both the male and the female gametophytes are only 1N. Now what happens is something very strange. In both the male and female gametophytes, fusion occurs in cells. So two cells actually grow together or fuse and become one. And when that happens, the male produces a structure called the antheridium. And after that fusion, the female produces a structure called the archegonium. Now, Now both of those structures are 2N. And if you'll notice up here, I'm drawing the 1N structures in blue and the 2N in green. Okay, does that make sense? Now what happens inside of the archegonium and the antheridium is then meiosis. And so meiosis occurs inside of either the archegonium or the antheridium. And what is produced in the male are 1N sperm, flagellated sperm. In the female, 1N ova are produced through meiosis. So this really isn't that much different than what we would think of in a typical sporophyte dominant life cycle. Okay. The main difference is the main part of the plant is actually 1N. They have a fusion of cells and grow a 2N structure on that 1N structure. Okay. Now what happens then is this 1N sperm is going to fuse with that 1N ovum, right? It's going to swim and fuse with the 1N ovum. When that occurs, how many N is the structure going to be?
2N,
right? Okay. Now I'm going to draw another female gametophyte here with a fused ovum. Okay. So here we have a female gametophyte again that's 1N. On it, they have this 2N archegonium. And inside we have a 2N zygote, right? After the fusion of the sperm and the ovum. What happens at this point is this 2N structure begins to grow. And it grows a stalk, what we call a stalk, a capsule with a little lid on it called an operculum. Okay. And then the lid is the operculum, right? Now all of those structures are 2N. Okay. Now here's where things get a little bit strange. Inside of the capsule, meiosis again occurs and produces 1N spores inside of the capsule. When that operculum or lid opens up, the spores are released, and if the spores land in a suitable environment, those spores are either male or female spores, and they'll produce a male or female gametophyte. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
This happens in the female or male?
In the female, because the sperm actually swims over and fertilizes inside of the female gametophyte. Okay, or inside of the archegonium. Any questions about that? So when we look at this picture here of a moss, the little plant-like structures down here, those are the gametophytes. They're 1N. They may either be male or female, right? We know some of them are female. Why?
Stalk.
Because we see these 2N structures on them, the stalk, the capsule, and the operculum. These structures that we see here, kind of sticking up above the plant, are actually the 2N structures that are a result of fertilization. Okay? Any questions about that? Now inside of those capsules, meiosis is going to again occur, and you're going to get 1N spores that are going to be released to make new 1N male or female gametophytes. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so mosses have a little bit different life cycle. This is a close-up view of a cap stalk, capsule, and operculum. You can see the capsule here, the stalk, and then the little lid on the top. This one's just a little bit more dried out here, ready to burst and release those 1N spores to produce the gametophytes. Okay. Any questions about the mosses? Now another group of plants that actually belongs to this division and has a similar life cycle, a gametophyte dominant life cycle, are the liverworts. And these are the archegonium of the liverworts here. These are actually the antheridia right here in the gametophyte. This is the gametophyte or the 1N part of the liverwort. Most of the time when people think of bryophytes, they think of mosses, but the liverworts also belong to this group. Now the way that they got the name liverwort, wort is Old English for plant. Okay, and so it actually, the name means liver plant. And I guess it kind of looks like a liver, the leaf, if you have a good imagination. In medieval times, the doctors, what they thought was that if you could find a plant that looked like an organ in the body, and you were having problems with that organ in the body, if you ate that plant, it would help to cure you of that ailment. Okay? And so they would actually give this plant to people with liver ailments in medieval times. Of course, we know that that doesn't work now, but that's what they thought. There's just another species of liverwort here. Any questions about the Bryophyta? Okay, so the transitional group of plants then that I mentioned is the Bryophyta. Okay, so we can put that up here. The next group of plants that we're going to talk about are what we call the lower vascular plants. The lower vascular plants, we're actually going to talk about three divisions. The first of them is the division Lycophyta. Okay. The division Lycophyta are sometimes called the whisk ferns and the ground pines is another common name for them. The Lycophyta is, as well as all the lower vascular plants, they're actually tied to water in some respects. All of the lower vascular plants produce flagellated sperm and they produce spores, which if they do that, then that indicates to us that they belong to or that they need aquatic environments in order to survive. Okay? And so where you will find these lower vascular plants is in aquatic or semi-aquatic environments. Right? Or around aquatic environments. For example, you'll find a lot of them along stream beds, or along stream banks, excuse me. You'll find some of them, see quite a few of them up in forests that are very wet, like up in Oregon, on dead trees, growing on dead trees and so forth. Okay. So this is a kind of a primitive group of plants. At one point in the Earth's history, this was the dominant type of plant during the Carboniferous period. And actually, have any of you ever been in a coal mine before? Okay, did you see the fossil plants in the coal seams at all? Happen to see them there? Next time you're in a coal mine, if you ever get in a coal mine, look at the coal seams and you'll see all these fossilized plants. Most of the fossilized plants are lower vascular plants because during the Carboniferous period, this was the dominant type of plants during, you know, the time of the dinosaurs. And actually, some of these plants that are the lower vascular plants, some of them were as tall as 30 meters tall. Now, most of these lower vascular plants today, a very tall plant would be maybe a meter tall. Okay. Did I say 30 meters? 30 feet. Okay. But most of them are no more than 3 feet tall. Most of them are much smaller than that nowadays. And the reason why we don't have these really large Lycophyta is, first of all, our world has become drier and drier than it was back in the time of the dinosaurs in the Carboniferous period. The second reason is that we have more advanced plants that have evolved since that time, such as the gymnosperms and angiosperms, the vascular plants. And so the vascular plants are much better competitors for, the true vascular plants are much better competitors for water and nutrient resources. So if you plant, for example, a Lycophyta in your flower gardens, it's not going to grow as good as your other plants or grow as fast, okay? Because the vascular tissue is just not as complex. Okay? Any questions about that? Now the Lycophyta, the club mosses, ground pines, and whisk ferns, one of the characteristics of these organisms is that they have a needle-like leaf, what we call a scale-like leaf. And so they have a leaf that looks a lot like a pine needle, what you would think of as a pine needle. Now, the way that you can tell the difference between these plants and a true conifer, or like a pine tree, is that these organisms only have a single vein running down that needle. If you look, everybody, when you go out of the class today, pick up one of the needles of the pines and firs around campus and just pull a needle off the tree and look at it, and you'll be able to see multiple veins running down that leaf. That makes sense. Okay. So these organisms only have a single vein, so again, more primitive vascular tissue. These organisms do have roots, however, the roots as well only have a single strand of vascular tissue, which means that they're just not as complex as some of the more vascular plants. They do reproduce asexually by vegetative asexual reproduction via rhizomes. Remember, rhizomes were underground horizontal stems. And again, you can see the sporing structures in this plant. They're found up there in the strobili at the very top of the plant. So the ground pines, club mosses, and wisp ferns actually have their sporing structures on the top of the stems, okay, which makes them kind of unique. Any questions about the ground pines? So this is just an example of a ground pine here. These plants that you're looking at are about, oh, probably 5 or 6 inches tall. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes size when you're looking at a, you know, on a big screen like this, but they're not very tall in this particular case. You can see the strobili or the sporing structures found on the tips of the stems, okay, of the aerial stems. You can see they have little needle-like leaves. If you were to look at those leaves, you would see that they have just a single vein in them. Okay. Any questions about the Lycophyta? This is very typical. I took this picture up near Vancouver, British Columbia, and you can see these ground pines actually growing on a dead and decaying log. Okay. And that's fairly common up in that country. Any questions about the Lycophyta? The next division we want to talk just briefly about is the division Spenophyta. The division Spenophyta are your, what we sometimes call the horsetails. Just adding those divisions to our list here of lower vascular plants. The horsetails, they have some other common names. Some of them are scouring rush. Some people call them joint grass. However, there are other grasses that have the common name of joint grass. This is kind of a typical horsetail here. Now, most of the horsetails that we have today are actually quite small. When I say small, they're again, less than 3 feet tall. However, there are some larger horsetails in the world today. However, in the fossil record, we see even larger horsetails. Again, you only find them around aquatic environments. This is a species of horsetail here. You can see they're actually taller than this lady. This lady's about, what, 5'2", 5'3"? So she's kind of short, but they can grow very tall. This is in South Africa. So there are some species of larger horsetails. Where they get their common name from is if you take one of these plants and kind of hold it upside down, I guess somebody thought it looked like a horse's tail. That's where they got their name. The horsetails that we have around here looks more something more like this. Okay. These organisms actually have reduced leaves. They don't have any visible leaves. One characteristic that's kind of unique, or somewhat unique, there's actually one other group of plants that does this, but they actually photosynthesize with their stems and not with their leaves. And so you see these stems here that are green, those are the structures that are photosynthesizing. These little kind of brownish structures around the joints in the stem are the leaves, and the leaves are non-functional, which means they don't photosynthesize. So when we look at these structures here, these are branches coming off of the main stem, and photosynthesis is occurring in the branches, not in the leaves. Okay. Any questions about that? Another characteristic is they have a distinctly jointed hollow stem. When I was a kid, we used to call these Robin Hood grass, because you could breathe underwater with them. They're hollow on the inside. You find them quite commonly along ditch banks around here. They do have a sporing structure on the terminal end or on the very end of the main stem. And so that characteristic, they're similar to the Lycophyta that we just talked about. They do have roots. Again, however, their vascular tissue is not as complex as what we would see think of as a typical plant, the higher vascular plants. They do reproduce asexually using rhizomes. And they can be quite weedy in aquatic and semi-aquatic environments. When I actually lived in Provo for a while when I was going to BYU, and my wife and I moved there, we actually bought a trailer home. We were living in a trailer park. Most of you know where the new mall is, right there off University Avenue. There used to be a trailer park there, and that's where we lived. And that's kind of wet from Utah Lake. It's really wet, wet soil and so forth that's there. We had this little space outside our trailer, and my wife decided we were gonna have a garden. So I dug up a little piece of our lawn and planted seeds. Come out a week later, and I'm thinking, man, I'm not that bad of a gardener. There was green coming up all over the place. And as the green things grew, I realized it wasn't what I planted. And what it was these these horsetails. We actually had a vacant lot back behind our trailer, and these horsetails were actually growing via rhizomes. And you'd pull them out of the garden, and they would have rhizomes that were extremely long as this room sometimes. And so they really reproduce very quickly using those rhizomes. Okay. Any questions about the horsetails? So again, photosynthetic stems, jointed, hollow stems, reduced leaves. They're non-functional leaves. The sporing structures found on the very tip of the terminal part of the plant, and they reproduce asexually using rhizomes. These are kind of some dried out horsetails. The strobili, or sporing structure there at the top of the plant, are releasing their spores. This is probably the most common type of horsetail that we have around here. They don't really even have any branches coming off, and they have the reduced leaves. And then again, you can see the sporing structure at the top. One other thing that's kind of interesting about the horsetails is all of the extant horsetails in the world today belong to a single genus, and that's the genus Equisetum. So that's another common name that I should have mentioned. Equisetum, equine, so kind of correlates with the common name. And when I say extant species, what does that mean? It's the opposite of extinct, so they're still alive today. There are other genera or genus of horsetails that are extinct, but the only one that we have on the earth today is the genus Equisetum. This one's actually Equisetum arvans, which is the one that's most common around here. This is, again, just another type of horsetail. Any questions about the Sphenophyta? The last division of lower vascular plants that we want to talk about is the division Pterophyta. The Pterophyta are sometimes called the ferns, okay? The true ferns. So the division Pterophyta includes the true ferns. Now again, these lower vascular plants, where do you typically find ferns? Any of you seen ferns before? There's not a lot of them here in Utah. Where at? Yeah, jungle areas where it's very humid. Actually, it's kind of interesting. The most diverse place in Utah for ferns is actually down in by Zion National Park. That kind of surprised you. If you think of it down there, it's dry. But next time you go hiking up one of those narrow slot canyons, look on the sides of the walls, and there will be ferns growing and ferns growing underneath the rocks. And that's because inside of those canyons, it's actually quite humid because the rivers in there are a little stream. And, you know, some of that water is evaporating, so inside of those little canyons, it's quite humid.
So it's just any, like, really humid environment is a good place for them.
Mm-hmm. Or we have a few ferns around here. You'll find them right along a stream.
The little, like, They'll like grow across the whole forest floor if it's...
If it's really humid, yeah. Like up in the northwest, there are ferns all over the place, and sometimes the ferns will grow quite tall. Usually they're not quite as tall, but sometimes they can. One of the strangest places I've ever seen ferns in Utah is down on a mountain range called the Elk Ridge. This is just so you know what a fern looks like. This is a picture of a fern here. Do you know where Elk Ridge is? Not the town, but the mountain range down by Blanding.
That's right, you line down there.
Yeah. You get up on Elk Ridge and it's really strange. It's a pretty dry environment, isn't it, up there? I mean, it's like pinyon juniper trees like we have in our foothills here, some ponderosa pine. But you get up on top of the Elk Ridge and you'll be driving along and you'll drop down into kind of a little valley up there, and there will be ferns waist high all up and down a valley. And the only thing that I can figure out is that, you know, you always find them where there's little streams of water, kind of in a valley where there's a stream. The only thing I can think of is that as that water evaporates, somehow it's held in those little valleys by the wind currents and so forth. But it's really a unique environment down there because it's kind of almost like a, it's not really a deserty environment, but it's, most of you, if I were to take you down there, you'd say, oh yeah, it's kind of a desert, right? It's like mahogany and shrubs and so forth, a lot of it. And it's really kind of an interesting ecosystem down there. So let's take a look at some of the characteristics of the ferns. The ferns do reproduce asexually via rhizomes again. They do have roots, but again, remember that they have primitive vascular tissue. Now, one thing that's fairly unique about the ferns is that the ferns don't grow branches or stems. What happens is the leaves grow directly from the rhizome. And each of these leaves, since they grow directly from the rhizome, has a special name. We call them fronds. Okay. So a frond is a leaf that grows from the rhizome in the ferns. Okay. Now, when you look at ferns, sometimes you'll see little structures that are called fiddleheads. It's like the end of a violin. What they are is the fronds, that's the way they first grow, and then they unravel and open up. And sometimes these fronds can be very large. I've actually seen fronds from ferns that are taller than me. Okay. Most of the ones that you'll see around here in Utah are smaller. The ones up on the Elk Ridge are actually about knee high. Maybe you knee to waist high, I should say. So the fronds can vary quite a bit in their size. Now, one thing that's unique about the Pteropoda in relationship to the other lower vascular plants is the sporing structures or sori are found on the underside of the leaf. Okay, so they don't have a sporing structure at the terminal end of the stem. One of the main reasons why is they don't have a main stem. Okay, so the sporing structures are found on the underside of the leaf. If you ever have ferns in your home, a lot of people like to grow ferns as house plants, which is kind of hard to do around here. But they'll actually sometimes think that there are spider nests on the bottoms of their fronds, and they'll actually pick them off, and the fern will die if you do that. They're actually the sori, or the sporing structure. So if you can look here at these ferns, you can see each of these fronds coming up separately or emerging separately. With this fern here, you can see all of the individual fronds. Okay. And this is a Boston fern. You can actually see the individual fronds coming up. Now this is just a single leaf here. A lot of the ferns have what we call highly dissected leaves. So it looks like it has multiple leaves on this stem, kind of. Does that make sense? But actually this is just a single leaf. If you look here, the leaf never really stops. It's just what we would call highly dissected. Okay. Most of you have seen dissected leaves before, but we don't see a lot of really highly dissected leaves like we see a lot with the ferns. For example, if you've ever looked at an oak leaf before, oak leaves are dissected, they're just not dissected as precisely as the ferns. So an oak leaf looks something like this. So they have dissected leaves, they're just not as dissected as many of the ferns. Not all ferns have dissected leaves, but some of them do. So it looks like they have multiple leaves coming off of a branch. But each one of these structures is a single frond here. Okay. Now this is looking at the underside of a frond. You can see these kind of yellowish structures in this particular species here on the undersides of the fronds. Those are the sporing structures of the sori. Okay. Any questions about the ferns? And again, here you see a whole mess of ferns. Some of them are a little bit larger. I actually took this picture down on the Elk Ridge. I should have. I have a landscape one that I need to get put into this presentation. This is some more ferns. I took this picture back in. What's it called? I can't remember the name of the national park. It's in Virginia. The Appalachian Mountains. Okay. You guys might have heard of it, the Appalachians. How many of you have heard it said like that? That's the wrong way to say it. You go back east, they call it the Appalachians. And then, any questions about the ferns? So, when we talk about our groups of plants here, we have our transitional group of plants that we talked about that belong to the Vision Bryophyta, the lower vascular plants which belong to the we had three divisions, within the lower vascular plants, the Lycophyta, the Spinophyta, and the Pteropoda. Okay. The next group of plants that we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk about a few divisions within this group of plants, are what we call the gymnosperms. Okay. Now these are higher vascular plants. All of the gymnosperms are going to have pollen grains, and they're going to produce seeds. Okay? They're going to have very, very complex vascular tissue. So these plants have evolved to live in drier environments. So we'll see a lot of the gymnosperms out in sometimes desert environments, sometimes just out in terrestrial types of environments. The last group of plants are the angiosperms. Now, the name gymno actually means naked, sperm means seed. The angiosperms, on the other hand, these are the flowering plants. So the flowering vascular plants belong to the angiosperms, the non-flowering vascular plants belong to the gymnosperms. And the big difference, there's actually a couple of differences between the angiosperms and gymnosperms. One is that the angiosperms have flowers, gymnosperms don't. Okay, that one's obvious enough. Mention that one. The second major difference is the types of seeds that they have. We're going to talk a little bit more about this when we get to the angiosperms, but in gymnosperms, such as in a pine tree, when we look at the seed actually has an embryo inside of the seed, okay? And then there's actually food that surrounds the embryo, okay? And if the seed lands, for example, on this desk, it still needs to respire. It's actually respiring very, very slowly. But it still needs to respire, and so it needs food. In addition, the seed needs food. Most of you know that you plant seeds in the soil, right? Most seeds anyways. It needs enough food to get a leaf grown above ground, right? So the photosynthesis can start occurring. And it also needs to start growing a root so that it can get water and nutrients for the plant to grow. And so it needs food to get going until it has a leaf above ground and can photosynthesize. Does that make sense to everybody? So seeds have to have food as well as the embryo, which is the zygote inside of the seed. Okay. Most of them will have what we call a seed coat or a covering around the seed that actually keeps them from drying out. But in the gymnosperms, they don't have as much food. And we're going to talk about why they don't have as much food when we talk about the angiosperms, actually. They're why the angiosperms have more food. Just kind of keep it in the back of your mind that the gymnosperms don't have as much food there. So if you plant a pine seed, for example, very deep, it actually won't have enough energy to get that leaf up above the ground. Okay, and so they'll actually die. Most Gymnosperm seeds, if you plant them more than just a couple of centimeters deep, they won't be able to survive. Okay, so you have to plant them very shallow. Some of them you actually have to plant right on top of the surface of the soil. All right. Any questions about that? So in the gymnosperms, we're going to talk about a few divisions within the gymnosperm group. The first is the division Cycadophyta. The division Cycadophyta are sometimes called the cycads. Okay? Easy enough, common name. Some people call them the palm-like plants because a lot of people think that they look like palms. In fact, a lot of the cycads are mistaken for palm trees. The cycads evolved in the Middle East, and so kind of in a semi-desert type of environment, and that's still where you find most of them today. They've actually been transplanted to places or moved to places like St. George. A lot of people will say that they have palm trees in their backyard in St. George, and most of them are not palm trees, they're actually cycad trees. Okay? And there's a big difference because palm trees are actually flowering plants. So this is a picture of a cycad. Now, the cycads have a very unique leaf. It's kind of a long leaf with a lot of dissections. These organisms, the cycads, actually grow tree-like. So they have this big old trunk here, and they'll grow in the shape of a tree. So this is what an adult cycad might look like that hasn't been groomed by its owner. You can see the big old trunk, so it has a woody trunk, kind of like a palm tree. Now most of you, if I didn't tell you that these were not palm leaves, you probably would have thought that they were palm trees, right? Okay. Palm trees, I actually have a picture of a palm leaf in the back of a cycad here in just a minute. But palm leaves, their leaves look like the palm of your hand. Therefore, that's where they get their name, palm trees. Okay. So it looks like a palm with fingers coming off of it. And this leaf is much straighter and highly dissected. Yeah.
So would like the yucca plants and the century plants and those be in this too?
No.
No.
They're actually flowering plants. Yeah. All of the cycads have the same type of leaf. Okay. And actually something kind of interesting around Jerusalem, did you know they don't have palm trees? They have pretty much all cycads.
So should and, be called Cycad Sunday?
Yeah, so Palm Sunday, which was what, two Sundays ago? Which was in biblical times, before Christ was crucified in the Bible, when he entered Jerusalem, they put palm leaves down for him to walk on. At least that's what it says in the Bible, right? Okay? And so Christians have a Sunday that they call Palm Sunday. And really, they didn't put palm leaves down, they really put cycad leaves down. So technically, we should call it Cycad Sunday instead of Palm Sunday. Okay. But you'll notice that in the cycads, they have both male and female trees. The males and female trees are separate. This is a female cone here in which seeds are being produced. Okay. This is just showing another cycad tree here. You can see these long, what most people would call a palm-like leaf. This one's actually been groomed by an owner. You can see the distinct trunk. If it were just growing wild, there would probably be those leaves coming out the entire way up the trunk, kind of like this tree here. Okay. This is a male cycad. This is the pollen cone that's produced on the male cycad trees. If you look up at the top of the picture up there, you can actually see a palm leaf there in the background. Can you see that?
Oh, yeah.
Looks like a palm of a hand. This is a palm leaf right here. Okay. Does that make sense, the difference between the two? Okay. So this is the pollen cone, and this pollen is going to be released in the wind, and hopefully it's going to find a female cone, or the ova in a female cone, fertilize it, and then produce seed. Okay. The cycad trees generally don't grow very tall. That's another big difference between palm trees and cycad trees. Usually palm trees will grow quite tall. Cycad trees, you know, don't grow much taller than 7 feet tall. That's actually a pretty tall cycad. So all those little tiny palm-like trees that you see in St. George are actually cycad trees. Any questions about the cycads? Okay, the next division that we're going to talk about is the netophyta. And I think I'm going to kind of end here, but let's just put these up here. The cycadophyta and the netophyta are both gymnosperms. We're actually going to talk about two other divisions within the gymnosperms. The netophyta are actually found in desert environments, and we have some netophyta around here. We'll come back on Wednesday, talk about the other gymnosperms, and then get into the angiosperms on Wednesday.